Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. The Industrial Workers of the World, a union whose fighting spirit has inspired workers since their founding in 1905. We dedicate this show to Local 100 Transport Workers Union, which carries on the militant union tradition today. Charlie King and Karen Brando are musical storytellers whose repertoire covers a century and a half and four continents. In this concert held at the Catholic Workers' House in New York City recently, they continue their new format of songs with storytelling, producing a stirring and insightful history of the IWW in words and song. And now dump the bosses off your back, 100 years of the industrial workers of the world with Charlie King and Karen Brando.
With the IWW, Catholic workers shared the goal of building a new society within the shell of the old. This year is the centennial of the IWW, and their example is especially valuable, you know, as we see the American Federation of Labor once again splitting over their inability to enthusiastically organize the working poor, especially immigrant poor. There's no better example of that than the IWW, as you'll see from this program, which I think pretty much speaks and sings for itself. We have very high expectations that you will sing on these songs, because that's what they were written for.
The industrial workers of the world, the IWW, or as they laughingly called themselves, the Wobblies. Never before or since has there been such an organization. Its members were always on the go, from job to job, from state to state, hopping freights, riding the rods to anywhere and everywhere. The Wobblies probably never had more than 60,000 active members at any one time, but they influenced millions, forever talking of solidarity, forever declaring that the working class, those who did the nation's work, should own the nation's industries.
The IWW emerged at the beginning of the 20th century and challenged the American Federation of Labor. For 20 years, the AF of L, under the leadership of Samuel Gompers, had used the medieval model of the guild or craft union to organize skilled workers, carpenters, plumbers, painters, printers, tailors, glass blowers, and cigar makers, into hierarchies of apprentice, journeyman, and master. The IWW organized workers that the AF of L considered unorganizable or undesirable: immigrants, people of color, migratory workers in agriculture, lumber, and construction, the unskilled. They rejected craft unionism for its obvious failure to adapt to changing industrial conditions. When workers of one AFL union went on strike, members of dozens of other AFL unions in the same plant routinely crossed the picket line and remained on the job, bound by the contracts their own craft union had negotiated with the plant owners. The IWW believed they could end these divisions with one big union.
Wobblies were militant hellraisers. They created stories, plays, and cartoon characters to get their message across. They had hundreds of songs which served them well, whether walking picket lines or sitting around campfires in the hobo jungles that followed the railroad tracks west. And they gave us the song that is known all around the world as the anthem of international labor unity.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever. Solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
At 10 a.m. on June 27, 1905, William D. Haywood walked to the front of Brands Hall in Chicago, picked up a piece of loose board and hammered on the table to silence the whispers in the crowded room. Fellow workers, this is the Continental Congress of the working class. We are here to confederate the workers of this country into a working class movement in possession of the economic powers, the means of life, in control of the machinery of production and distribution without regard to capitalist masters.
Big Bill Haywood, a massive, stoop-shouldered man, had been a cowboy, a homesteader, and a miner. Blinded in one eye in a mine accident, Big Bill left the Silver City, Utah mines at the turn of the century to become an organizer for the Western Federation of Miners and the Socialist Party.
I do not care a snap of my fingers whether or not the skilled workers join the industrial movement at this time. We're going to go down into the gutter to get at the mass of workers and bring them up to a decent plane of living.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Forever, for the union makes us strong.
The Industrial Workers of the World was committed to equality for women workers from its very inception. Shortly after its founding, the IWW would draw brilliant female organizers to its standard, the most notable being Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. She joined in 1906 at age 16.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. I really should tell you something about where the IWW stood in relation to other organizations because the picture is probably not too clear. Well, it was an industrial union and it was opposed to the American Federation of Labor, bitterly so. It did not stand for any of the things that the AFL stood for: fair day's wage for a fair day's work, a brotherhood of capital and labor, none of those things. It was strong for fighting the boss every time we got a chance.
By organizing industrially, said the preamble to the IWW Constitution, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. From the start, the IWW refused to sign contracts with employers. They scorned pensions, insurance, and death benefits as pitiful concessions to a decaying social order. In speaking about the IWW, the key words are always freedom, solidarity, democracy, direct action, revolution, rank and file control, humor, imagination, and an injury to one is an injury to all. With high enthusiasm and low dues, the IWW set about its work and accomplished marvels.
Is there aught we hold in common with the greedy parasite who would lash us into serfdom and would crush us with his might? Is there any choice left to us but to organize and fight when the union makes us strong? Forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
The IWW believed that job control was the speediest route to the new society. The idea of capturing power at the ballot box was not particularly attractive to them. Most workers were barred from the polls. All women, all workers under 21, all foreign-born workers not yet citizens. The vast majority of working America were legally disenfranchised. In those parts of the United States where black labor was dominant, procedural harassments and outright intimidation kept most blacks from voting. Other large blocks of workers, seamen, hobos, and lumberjacks, couldn't register to vote without a fixed address. To place labor's hope on the ballot box seemed to select a field of combat where working class power was weak, instead of concentrating on the point of production where the power was strongest.
Fred Thompson, the industrial workers of the world, took that name to declare its hope that organization could end the use of workers against each other anywhere, in the same plant or in the same industry, or across oceans, in peace or in war, either to cut each other's pay or to kill each other's kids. That is still its aim today. In 1905, North American unions divided workers by their craft. It was a time of extensive immigration, and many trade union locals turned away the newcomers. The IWW wanted to arrange that all workers in the same mill, mine, or factory could bargain as one unit, arranging for support from workers in all industries across the country as one big union, the OBU.
Bring the good old Red Book boys, we'll sing another song. Sing it to the wage slave who has not yet joined the throng of the revolution that will sweep the world along to the one big industrial union.
Hurrah! Hurrah! The truth will make you free. Hurrah! Hurrah! When will you workers see? The only way you'll gain your economic liberty is one big industrial union. You migratory workers of the common labor class, we sing to you to join and be a fighting union man. You must emancipate yourself, you proletarian, with one big industrial union. Hurrah! 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 The truth will make you free. Hurrah! Hurrah! When will you workers see? The only way you'll gain your economic liberty is one big industrial union.
The IWW message was spread through their newspaper, The Industrial Worker, through pamphlets and magazines, and thousands of copies of The Little Red Songbook. Many of these were in foreign languages: Swedish, Finnish, Hungarian, Lithuanian, Russian, Flemish, Yiddish, Italian, and Spanish, published in American cities to meet the needs of the ethnic groups whose members carried red IWW membership cards.
The Wobblies united black and white workers as never before in American history and maintained solidarity and equality regardless of race. Most labor organizations have yet to equal it.
Bill Haywood. In order to have a healthy workers' movement in America, it is necessary to organize the huge mass of Negroes. They must be organized, whatever it costs, and brought into contact with the wide masses of worker immigrants who haven't caught the stupid racial prejudices of native white workers. Meanwhile, education work goes on, aimed at compelling the trade unions to open their doors to Negroes.
Frank Cedarvall. One of the strongest locals was in Philadelphia, where the IWW retained job control on the docks from 1913 to 1924. Approximately half of the peak membership of 4,000 was black, with the remainder composed mainly of Poles, Lithuanians, and Latin Americans from various nations. The major organizer was Ben Fletcher, the most important black leader to emerge in the IWW. And the local chairmanship was rotated monthly between blacks and non-blacks. Just as the welcome mat put out for blacks was crucial to the success on the Philadelphia docks, the full membership offered to Hispanics was key to organizing on the Atlantic Run. Over half of all the firemen on that run were Spanish-speaking.
Utah Phillips. Now most people know some of the IWW songs. We had terrific songwriters, like Ralph Chaplin, Richard Brazier, T-Bone Slim, Joe Hill. Their songs are very, very simple. A lot of working folks came from other countries, couldn't speak very much English, and didn't have a chance to go to school there. If songs were going to communicate, they had to be simple. Are you poor, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? What do you do?
Dump the bosses off your back.
Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you see your troubles scattered? Dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Are you loaded like a long-eared jack? Boo, why don't you buck like thunder
and dump the bosses off your back?
All the agony you suffer, you can end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer,
and dump the bosses off your back. Dump the bosses off your back.
Scab, a person who works after a strike has been called and who takes the job of a striking worker. Oscar Ameringer. There's three kind of scabs: the professional, the amateur, and the union scab. Now, the professional scab is usually a high-paid, high-skilled worker in the employ of strike-breaking and detective agencies. He knows what he is doing, does it well, and for the sake of the long green only. Now, the amateur scab brigade is composed of bums, riffraff, college students, and other undesirable citizens. The amateur scab gets much glory, little pay, and when the strike is over, he's given an honorable discharge in the region where Darwin searched for the missing link. The union scab receives less pay than the professional scab, works better than the amateur scab, and don't know that he is a scab.
Now, the classic union scab was Mr. Block. A block-headed worker whose naive faith in capitalism, church, and state led to one calamity after another. He first appeared in a comic strip created by Ernest Reeve. If you'll kindly pay attention, I'll introduce to you a man that is a credit to the red, white, and blue. His head is made of lumber as solid as a rock. He is a common worker, and his name is Mr. Block. And Block, he thinks he may be president someday. Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake, you make me ache. Tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake.
Yes, Mr. Block is lucky. He found a job by G. The shark got $7 for job and fare and fee. They shipped him to a desert and dumped him with his truck. But when he tried to find his job, he sure was out of luck. He shouted, "That's too rough. I'll fix them with the law."
Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake.
You take the
cake. You make me ache.
You make
tie a rock on your block.
Tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake.
Block hiked back to the city, but wasn't doing well. He said, "I'll join the union, the great AF of L." He got a job next morning, but was fired in the night. He said, "I'll see Sam Gompers and we'll fix that foreman right." Sam Gompers said, "You see, you have our sympathy."
Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake.
Cake!
You take the cake.
Ache!
You make me ache. Tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake.
Election day, he shouted, a socialist for mayor. The comrade was elected, Block happy was for fair. But after the election, he got an awful shock when a great big socialistic cop, he rapped him on his block. And comrade Block did sob. I helped him get his job.
That's right. Oh, Mr. Block, you were born by mistake. You take the cake. You make me ache. Tie a rock on your block and go jump in the lake. Kindly do that for liberty's sake.
Mr. Block was written by Joe Hill, who was a Swede born Joel Emanuel Hagland. Joe came to the United States about 1901 at the age of 19. By 1910, he was an IWW member, active around the port of San Pedro, California. He took part in the San Pedro dock workers' strike, the San Diego Free Speech Campaign, and an abortive revolution in Tijuana, which aimed to make Lower California into a workers' commune. Hill had been a member of the IWW for 3 years before he was framed on a murder charge in Salt Lake City. He, more than any other writer, had made the IWW a singing movement. He was the author of dozens of wobbly songs which were printed on song cards and published in The Industrial Worker, Solidarity, and in The Little Red Songbook. Joe Hill's songs swept across the country in jails, hobo jungles, union halls, picket lines, and demonstrations.
Many decades after a Utah firing squad ended his life, Joe Hill remains a figure of heated controversy. The cause for which he lived and died, working class emancipation, a free and egalitarian society, still beckons. The class war continues more intensely than ever. And as long as it lasts, people will argue for and against Joe Hill and the principles he courageously upheld to the end.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
In Salt Lake, Joe, by God, says I. Him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead.
Says Joe, but I ain't dead.
The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man.
Says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die.
And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, Joe says what they could never kill went on to organize.
Went on to organize.
Joe Hill ain't dead, he says to me. Joe Hill ain't never died. Where workers strike and organize, Joe Hill is at their side. Joe Hill is at their side.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Irma Lombardi. When the big strike came in Patterson, I was 17. I'd been working for 3 years by then. I was all for it. We thought we were going to change the world. During the strike, a lot of forces were put against us. The morning newspaper was one. The newspaper criticized the strikers and the organizers, especially the organizers. Agitators. A bunch of agitators are in Patterson. That's what they would write. I used to get mad reading it. I said, they aren't agitating us. They're telling us the truth. Organizers don't break laws by helping poor people. Girlie Flynn called a meeting just for the women one day. She started with that lovely way of hers. She looked at us and said, would you like to have nice clothes? We replied, oh, yes. Would you like to have nice shoes? Oh, yes, we shouted. Well, you can't have them. Your boss's daughters have those things. We got mad. We knew it was true. We had shoes with holes, and they had lovely things.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving, midst the wonders we have made. But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
Utah Phillips, slow rolling freight from the South Ogden yard, easing along down the line. The Pig Hollow Jungle Camp pulls into view. You roll off, and here's what you find. The ruins and ashes lie scattered around. The jungle is empty and bare. The shanties and tents all burned to the ground. Not a fire or a friend anywhere. Now, a rich man, he lives in a house made of stone, high on a hill looking down. A poor man, he lives in a tar paper shack, way out on the backside of town. But a rich man don't worry about his fine house. Oh, it's protected like you never saw, while a poor man gets railroaded out by the cops and his house gets burned down by the law. A poor man is fighting for all that he has. He stands with his back to the wall. A rich man, he spends nearly half of his life just chasing a little white ball. But the rich man, he says that Pig Hollow must go. It's a place where the crooks rendezvous. But don't you suppose if you burn down a bank, you might flush out a scoundrel or two? Your bulldozer's rolling through my part of town. The iron ball swings, they knock it all down. They knock down my flophouse. They knock down my bars and they blacktop it over to park all your cars. So where do I go and where do I stay when they knock down Skid Row and haul it away? I'll flag a fast rattler, ride it on down. Boys, they're running the bums out of town. You run out the hookers that work on the street. Then you build the big hall where the playboys can meet. My bookie shop closed when your cops pulled a raid. But you built a new hall for the stock market trade. Where will I go? Where will I go? And where will I stay when they knock down the Skid Row? When they knock down the Skid Row and haul it away, I'll flag a fast rattler, flag a fast rattler, and ride it on down, boys. They're running the bums out of town. Now I've come to find there's just one kind of war. That's the one going on between the rich and the poor. I don't know a lot about what they call class, but the upper and the middle can all kiss my s***. And where will I go? Where will I stay? When they knock down the skid row and haul it away, I'll flag a fast rattler and ride it on down. Boys, they're running the bums out of town.
The IWW Hall was one of the few places that a hobo could find companionship, a place to rest, and a meal. The Wobbly headquarters usually included a kitchen where a large pot of mulligan stew simmered on the stove and an enamel coffee pot was kept full. Radical literature was available for all to read. Often there was a piano put to use by a Wobbly who picked out popular tunes and led some singing.
Oh, why don't you work like other men do?
How the hell can I work when there's no work to do?
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Oh, why don't you save all the money you earn?
If I didn't eat, I'd have money to burn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Oh, I like the boss. He's a good friend of mine. That is why I am starving out on the bread line. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Whenever I get all the money I earn, the boss will be broke and to work he must turn.
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Joseph Etter. The workers are more powerful with their hands in their pocket than all the property of the capitalists. As long as the workers keep their hands in their pockets, the capitalists cannot put their hands in there. If the workers of the world want to win, all they have to do is recognize their own solidarity. They have nothing to do but fold their arms, and the world will stop. All the world that's owned by idle drones is ours and ours alone. We have waylaid the wide foundation, built it skyward stone by stone. It is ours not to slave in, but to master and to own, while the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Solidarity forever.
Solidarity
forever. For the union makes us strong.
The tactics of direct action found expression during the next few years in various forms of pressure applied by IWW members through strikes, free speech fights, boycotts, and demonstrations.
Across the country, from Tacoma, Washington to Skowhegan, Maine, the message of one big union stimulated strikes among loggers, miners, smeltermen, window washers, paper makers, silk workers, and streetcar workers. Wobblies staged the first sit-down strike in America at the Schenectady, New York plant of the General Electric Company in December 1906. In the frontier town of Goldfield, Nevada, an IWW strike won a minimum of $4.50 a day for most of the cooks, waiters, and bartenders. In Portland, Oregon, the IWW helped win a 9-hour day and a wage increase for sawmill workers. Lawrence, Massachusetts was a mill town. Of 86,000 people living in its borders, 32,000 worked for the mills. 27 different ethnic groups, speaking 22 different languages. They came to find a haven, but the 10-hour, $2 day, 25 cents a day for children, made Lawrence their purgatory.
January 11, 1912 began as just another payday at the Everett Mills in Lawrence. It would not remain so for long. The state had recently enacted a law shortening the work week from 56 to 54 hours with no cut in pay. But workers worried that manufacturers would compensate by illegally trimming their meager wages. These fears were soon confirmed. Moments after the first workers anxiously opened their envelopes, the cry, "Short pay!" rang out. Then, as word of the cut spread, a group of Polish women shut off their machines and walked out.
The next morning, the strike spread to other mills. The women went from room to room, smashing light bulbs, cutting belts, shredding cloth, and pulling non-strikers from their machines. "Better to starve fighting than to starve working," they shouted. Within 4 days, 10,000 men, women, and children were on strike. Within another week, 22,000 had left their jobs. One striker carried a sign that read, "We want bread, and we want roses, too." The words became an emblem for the strike. As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched by all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, "Bread and roses, bread and roses." As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, we bring the greater days. The rising of the women is the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler, ten that toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories. Bread and roses, bread and roses. The poverty and the danger of a prolonged strike fell hardest on the children of the strikers.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. We took some of the children away from Lawrence to other cities once or twice, and then they tried to stop us, and they beat up the children and the mothers and the committee in the railroad station in Lawrence and took them to jail. And a protest and roar went up from one end of the country to the other. They tore down that railroad station later. I'm sure one reason is that they didn't want people to be pointing at it as the place where the police and the soldiers had beaten the women and children.
6 weeks into the strike on February 24th, Flynn tried to put another 40 children on a train for Philadelphia. The police, with clubs drawn, attacked the group, arresting 15 parents and children, and they sent 10 terrified children to the Lawrence Poor Farm. The newspapers headlined the situation, and the publicity forced Congress to investigate the conditions in the shops. The strike was won by mid-March, with wage increases from 5 to 25%. The largest increases went to the lowest paid workers. They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn. But without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel shall turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
Intermittent strikes, strikes on the job, and sabotage were means of gaining practical concessions quickly, as well as part of the long-term battle to weaken the capitalist system. In 1915, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn wrote, "Sabotage means either to slacken up and interfere with the quantity or to botch in your skill and interfere with the quality of capitalist production so as to give poor service. Sabotage is not physical violence. Sabotage is an internal industrial process. It is simply another form of coercion."
Sabotage symbols of a wooden shoe and a black cat appeared constantly in wobbly illustrations and cartoons. Stickers and circulars showed a black cat displaying its claws. The words "sab cat," "kitten," "fix the job," were used to suggest or threaten striking on the job, sabotage, and direct action.
The boss has cream for his lordly dinner. Feed him milk and make him thinner. Hurry now, wonder how. Meow, sabotage. If you are down and the boss is gloating, trust in me instead of voting. Hurry now, wonder how. Meow, sabotage. Oh, the rats all hate and fear me. Meow, meow. The softest paw can be a claw. They seldom venture near me. Hoorah, they saw your sabotage kitten. Hoorah, they saw your sabotage kitten. Oh, the fight is tough and you can't see through it. Shut your traps and a cat will do it. Hurry now, wonder how. Meow, sabotage. The tiger wild in his jungle sitting never fights like this here kitten. Hurry now, wonder how. Meow, sabotage. Oh, the rats all hate and fear me. Meow, meow. The softest paw can be a claw. They seldom venture near me. Hoorah, they saw your sabotage kitten. Hoorah, they saw your sabotage kitten.
In order to squelch wobbly organizing, a number of Western cities declared street speaking against the law. Missoula, Montana, 1907. Spokane, Washington, 1909. Fresno, California, 1910. San Diego, California, 1912. Everett, Washington, 1916. The IWW conducted about 30 major free speech fights of up to 6 months' duration, all of them centered on the IWW's right to recruit members at street meetings.
Utah Phillips. Now, one of the songs for the Spokane free speech fight was composed by Joe Hill and was introduced to the streets by Haywire Mac McClintock, a well-known singer, very active in the IWW in those parts. Haywire would hide in a doorway with T-Bone Slim. A mass of workers would be gathered around the Salvation Army donut dollies. A man would walk by carrying an umbrella and a briefcase and dressed in a tight suit with a string tie and a bowler hat. He looked just like a banker, but functioned like a carnival shill. He'd yell, I've been robbed. Help, I've been robbed. Everyone would rush over to him. What's the matter? What's the matter? They'd ask. When enough had crowded around, he'd shout, I've been robbed by the capitalist system. And then the boys would jump out from the doorway and start singing Joe Hill's song. Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what is right. When you ask how about something to eat, they will answer in voices so sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land beyond the sky. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. Oh, the Starvation Army, they play. And they sing, and they clap, and they pray. Till they get all your coin on the drum. Then they tell you that you're on the bum. And you will eat.
You will eat.
By and by.
By and by.
In that glorious land beyond the sky.
Way up high.
Work and pray.
Work and pray.
Live on hay.
Live on hay.
You'll get pie in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
If you fight hard for children and wife, try to get something good in this life. You're a bad man and sinner, they tell. When you die, you will sure go to hell. But you will eat.
You will eat.
By and by.
By and by.
In that glorious land beyond the sky. Work and pray.
Work and pray.
Live on hay.
Live on hay.
And you'll get pie in the sky when you die.
That's a lie.
Working folks of all countries unite. Side by side we for freedom will fight. When the world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain. You will eat by and by, when you learn how to cook and how to fry. Chop some wood, 'twill do you good. And you will eat in the sweet by and by. And that's no lie.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. Their techniques were something like the Freedom Riders of today. They would send telegrams. Now I'm explaining, you understand, I'm not agitating. They would send out telegrams something like this. Footloose wobblies, come at once. Defend the Bill of Rights. And they would come on top of the trains and beneath the trains and on the sides and the boxcars and every way that you didn't have to pay fare. By the hundreds, literally, they would land in these communities to the horror and consternation of the authorities. And they would stand up on platforms or soapboxes and they would read part of the Constitution of the United States or the Bill of Rights until the cops came and took them away.
Jack Miller, there were so many of us there in the jail that there wasn't room to lie down. We had to make a system where men would lie partially on top of one another in order to get some rest. The diet we had was bread and coffee once a day. Well, that lasted 3 days. Then we decided to retaliate by building a battleship. This was IWW jargon for doing unpleasant things for the benefit of the jailer. Since there were no tin cups or bars to bang, about 20 of us went into the center of the room, locked our arms, and jumped as high as we could. The aggregate weight, which was about a ton and a half, came down in one spot. Buildings are not made to sustain such abuse, and it wasn't long until almost everyone was in the circle. People who were observing from outside have since told me that the building began to sway. Finally, Mayor Gill came and promised better food and some blankets. The meals did get a lot better, but the blankets were a mixed blessing as they were infested.
The Industrial Worker, April 14th, 1917. I love my flag, I do, which floats upon the breeze. I also love my arms and legs and neck and nose and knees. One little shell might spoil them all or give them such a twist They would be of no use to me. I guess I won't enlist. I love my country, yes I do. I hope her folks do well. Without her arms and legs and things, I think we'd look like hell. Young men with faces half shot off are unfit to be kissed. I've read in books, it spoils their looks. I guess I won't enlist.
Preceding and during World War I, the IWW took an anti-militarist stand, opposed the entrance of the United States into the war, and continued to lead strikes in contrast to the no-strike pledge of the AFL. Since the 1905 founding of the IWW, the organization had opposed war not only on the basis of anti-militarism, but on the grounds of anti-nationalism and anti-capitalism as well.
Ralph Chaplin, stand by the flag, the lie that still allures. Lay down your lives for land you do not own, and spill each other's guts upon the field, your glory gift of mangled flesh and bone. But whether in the fray to fall or kill, you must not pause to question why nor where. You see the tiny crosses on that hill? It took all those to make one millionaire.
Employers vented their fury on dissenters who, they claimed, were threatening national security and the capitalist system. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Daily World editorialized, "The first step in the whipping of Germany is to strangle the IWWs. Kill them, just as you would kill any other kind of snake. It's no time to waste money on trials and continuances and things like that. All that is necessary is the evidence and a firing squad."
Army troops and community vigilante groups raided IWW halls and members' homes across the country, dispersed outdoor gatherings, disrupted meetings, and jailed members.
The industrial worker printed a notice in one of their issues. "To our patrons, notice. Parties desiring to raid any of the various offices of the IWW, please book your dates in advance, as this form of amusement is very popular."
Across the country in 1917, 184 IWW members were arrested by federal agents and charged with interfering with the war effort, encouraging resistance to the draft, conspiring to cause insubordination and disloyalty in the armed forces, and injuring citizens who sell munitions to the government. Approximately 100 IWW defendants, including Big Bill Haywood, were convicted and received severe sentences, 20 years imprisonment in the case of the better-known leaders.
The post-war years were marked by further criminal prosecutions of the IWW in many states. In addition, community hostility toward every form of radicalism led to continued harassment of the organization.
Wobbly prisoners kept active and alert through their jail terms. They maintained their organizational identity within the prison, elected committees, planned education programs, and circulated books and literature. They asserted their rights within the jails as they had done on their jobs. Direct action techniques were used to obtain better jail conditions.
Despite the corporation-inspired U.S. government terrorism against it, the IWW continued to grow, and to grow mightily, throughout the next 5 years. The union reached its all-time peak membership in 1924.
And today, does anyone really believe that we can find effective solutions to the pressing problems of our time? Racism, sexism, homophobia, homelessness, globalization, and environmental destruction. With anything less than the freest and most revolutionary imagination and creativity.
Joe Hill and the old-time Wobblies are still very popular among young radicals and have a profound influence on many contemporary social movements. The Wobblies' dream of a better world and the means they imagine and improvise to realize that dream have never ceased to touch the hearts and minds of those who value freedom above all and who are now daring to dream revolutionary dreams of their own.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of armies, magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dump the Bosses Off Your Back, 100 Years of the Industrial Workers of the World with Charlie King and Karen Brandau.
I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report. And if you'd like to get in touch with Building Bridges, you can write Mimi, that's M-I-M-I, at buildingbridgesonline.org. Ken and I would love to hear from you.